I'm Brandi Cruz. Today on Undivided, as the weather heats up, get ready for more gaslighting on gas prices. Plus, Governor Jay Inslee has officially signed a bill that will mandate DEI-friendly curriculum across Washington's public school system. And why are some local mayors charging people to attend their State of the City addresses? We'll discuss that and more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. Welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. I'm Brandi Cruz. It's getting warmer out. It's getting nice out. I mean, today's sort of an exception. We had a few beautiful days, unseasonably warm. It was glorious. But as we approach summer, one thing is a certainty, that gas prices are going to go up. That's going to happen everywhere. It's going to happen in Washington. It's going to happen across the country. There is a natural ebb and flow due to a variety of factors for gas prices seasonally to go up and down. Of course, that is a reality. But beware of the gaslighting. Beware of the gaslighting in Washington State in particular that tries to convince you that the only reason you're seeing higher gas prices here are factors that are completely out of our government's control, because that's just not true. You know, Governor Inslee, when they began the carbon tax at the beginning of 2023, and he had denied, oh no, the Climate Commitment Act's not going to raise gas prices. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And everybody's like, well, yeah, it is. That's what it's designed to do. And then, of course, you started to see gas prices spike. And for the big a big chunk of 2023, they were high. And at one point in the summer of 2023, we had the highest gas prices in the nation. And then naturally, as you approach kind of winter and around election time, they started to dip down. At the end of the year, the governor's like, I don't know what people are talking about the carbon tax, he won't call it that, but about the cap and trade system raising gas prices, because our gas prices have dropped by like a dollar in recent months. What he fails to explain is that, sure, they dropped seasonally with others in the country, as it often does, but they would be even cheaper if we didn't have the carbon tax. So we would be even lower. And that's sort of where they try to confuse people. But we're ticking back up. And of course, Washington is going to have some of the highest gas prices in the country. Right now, we're at number three. We're number three. We're number three. Nicole? Oh. We're number three. Which we could be number one, right? We're number three, $4.33 on average. Hawaii's up higher. Like, you have to go find number two. You got to go to an island. Hawaii, $4.70, then California, $4.92. So not only is it our cap and trade system here in Washington State, but it's also, of course, we rely heavily on the gas tax. And so our taxes per gallon of gasoline are very high. Now, King 5 News, they had an article out, and I was like, yay, King 5. Nicole?
Oh, yay King 5.
Yay, King 5. And I was like, wow, King 5's actually talking about how our gas prices are just egregiously high. And then I read the article and I was deeply disappointed with King 5 all over again. The headline, filling up the gas tank is emptying the pockets of Washington residents. And I was like, yeah, it is. Yeah, thanks, King 5. And then they didn't mention anything about the carbon tax. Nope. It says, according to AAA, the current average for gas in the state is about $4.72. That number is about 84 cents more than the national average. It's up 9 cents in the past week and 38 cents more than last month. And then some dude, I'm assuming with AAA, I don't know, says, demand is going up. Temperatures are warmer. Americans are getting outside more and more. There's spring break travel. The fact that demand is up, we're changing over to the summer blends and refineries are doing maintenance. And basically the three big examples of why gas prices go up. He says they'll hit a peak in April or May. He expects Seattle gas stations to reach the $5 per gallon mark. And then he gives these reasons. Cost of labor is higher. Taxes are higher. And so all of that is a function that goes into what the retailer is going to charge for a gallon of gasoline. Now, he hits on taxes there. But all of these things that King 5 mentions or allows their expert to mention in the story, temperatures, spring break travel, the cost of labor, taxes, whatever. No mention in the whole article about, also there's an initiative that's going to be on the ballot in November to repeal the Climate Commitment Act, which will drop gas prices because it's increasing gas prices
right
now.
They just normalized it. They just said, it's everybody. Everybody's just having to pay more. It's summer.
It's all these things. Don't worry about it. I've never argued that gas prices are singular, you know, that Inslee is singularly to blame for gas prices, or that the president of the United States is singularly to blame for gas prices. There's, of course, a variety of factors, some domestically, some internationally, supply and demand, all of those things. But again, our prices would be lower in Washington state per gallon without the carbon tax. That's just a fact. It's going to be, I think, the normal gaslighting that we get on that, because politicians love to take blame for low gas prices, or they love to take, you know, like, oh, that credit for low gas prices. But then when it's high gas prices, they're like, oh, well, that's out of my control.
You Russia,
know, it's like, okay, Russia and Ukraine or whatever it is. But the gaslighting is going to be particularly strong this summer on this issue in particular because of the fight that is brewing over the initiative to repeal the Climate Commitment Act. So they're going to do everything they can to distract from when you're really feeling the pinch. I would argue a lot of people are feeling the pinch right now, but come April, May, you're paying $5 a gallon again. They are really going to try to distract from how much the carbon tax and the cap and trade program is contributing to that. So I just wanted you to be aware. And I also, the easiest way for you to remember this, because the initiatives can be a little confusing. I mean, we're fighting from now until Election Day to get all three initiatives that are on the ballot passed. So in case it confuses you, like, if I'm opposed to the policy, you vote yes. And Let's Go Washington and Brian Haywood have a handy slogan, which you can tell your friends so they can remember easily. Vote yes, pay less. It's good. Vote yes, pay less.
For some reason, Payless shoe stores.
I'm picturing myself. Hey, stop ruining the slogan. That's all they need to know. Vote. If you vote yes, you'll pay less. Super easy. I would challenge the opposition to come up with a catchier slogan than that.
It's pretty good.
I think Brian Haywood came up with that one himself. I'm like, good job, Brian. Vote yes, pay less. Vote no. I don't know. They're going to come up with something. It's going to be terrible. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's my whole spiel. Is just look out for the gaslighting. You know what's going on. All right, Governor Inslee this week, I wanted to follow up because, of course, some of the terrible bills that were discussed, some of them passed this legislative session. Now the governor is putting pen to paper. And so there's another opportunity to remind you about them and to talk about them. And one of them is Senate Bill 5462, which, if you'll recall, will mandate Seattle-like inclusive learning standards for every school district in the state. Here's Governor Jay Inslee signing Senate Bill 5462 into law.
This is Senate Bill 5462. It directs the Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction to screen for biases in learning standards. The bill also directs the School Directors Association to establish a model policy requiring schools include the perspectives of historically marginalized or underrepresented groups. It aligns with our diversity, equity, and inclusion policies and will help make more students feel welcome at school. Thanks, Senator Leas, and all who worked on this.
I'm glad he mentioned Senator Leas, even though Senator Leas wasn't there. Yeah, thanks, Senator Leas, for thrusting your personal ideology onto school districts across the state. That's really what this is about. You know, when they have the headlines, oh, this will help make schools and curriculum more inclusive. Well, that sounds great. Who's going to push back against making our schools more inclusive? But that's not what this is about. This is about, and I'll just read from a portion of the bill that I pulled. It's about creating a model policy and procedure that requires school district board of directors to adopt inclusive curricula and select so many woke words, diverse, equitable, inclusive, age-appropriate instructional materials that include the histories, contributions, and perspectives of historically marginalized and underrepresented groups, including but not limited to people from various racial, ethnic, and religious backgrounds, people with different learning needs, people with disabilities, LGBTQ people, and people with various socioeconomic and immigration backgrounds. So this is overload. This is about inclusivity overload, about forced DEI, which we know is an absolute failure, and it's just another thing that's distracting from the purpose of our public school system. I've said it before, if everything was going great in our public school system, the grades and test scores were high, and you want to focus on some other things to make it more well-rounded, whatever, but that's not the case. We know that across the board, our test scores are in the toilet. The number of kids who are coming to school on a regular basis in terms of attendance is in the toilet. We spend like $18,000 per pupil. And instead of focusing this legislative session on, hey, how can we improve educational and academic outcomes for our kids, they're focusing on stuff like this. In a bill to make it harder for parents to object to certain books that their kids are taught in school. So that's the kind of stuff that just speaks to the failure of one-party rule and of our government. But this is going to, I mean, we've already seen, you know, again, it sounds harmless to say, oh, more inclusive learning material. But how many stories have we done on material that was maybe chosen for its inclusive nature that was deeply mortifying? I mean, they mention here, you know, curricula that talks about immigrant backgrounds. Remember the book that was read to 10th graders at a Seattle school that was about a mom from Africa who'd immigrated to the country with her daughter, and her daughter, you know, was making out with some boy on the couch, and as a punishment, her mom makes her undress from the waist down and get on her bed and spread her legs and threatens to shove a hot pepper up her hoo-ha? And they picked that because it was like part of some like, oh, cultural, it's like, okay, first of all, that's a weird cultural example to give for African immigrants. And does it have to be sexually explicit? And in that same book, it was like the guy that the daughter was making out with was like forcing himself on her and like licking her, you know, without her consent. So it was like, so you want to talk about background, different backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, immigrants and stuff. That's fine. Like, I have no issue with that. But why are you choosing books that are grotesque and perverse? So that's the concern here. And when it comes to the LGBTQ community, you'll remember the committee hearing, this kind of went viral after we posted it, with a Republican lawmaker being like, that's cool, you know, have your diverse books. Can we just agree that none of them are pornographic in nature? And the Democrat on the committee was like, nah, we're not going to vote for that. I was like, we can't vote that, hey, you can have your inclusive material, but it just can't be porn? Because he gave an example of a book called Jack of Hearts, where it's about a boy who's gay and has a really active sex life and is being attacked for his sex life, but he likes sex so much, and it's just about sex. That's what the whole book is about, sex, 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 sex. So it's like, you guys, you want to be inclusive, but for some reason, as you pick these books and learning material for underrepresented groups, you pick stuff that's not by any measure age appropriate. So even though you put age appropriate in the bill, the stuff you're already doing isn't age appropriate. And also, this is now putting local school districts even more under the thumb of the superintendent of public instruction, Chris Reichdahl, who, do you think he's been on this show? Did he push back against some of this crazy gender ideology and political ideology being pushed on kids? No, he just punted on those questions. So the idea that you're going to put age-appropriate things, it's ridiculous because we already know. And you're focusing on the wrong thing, and that is the overarching issue. Okay, an update on a story. We had Jonathan Cho on the show yesterday to talk about a whole number of things, talk about his visit to San Francisco, which was horrifying. He said it's 10 times worse there than any of the worst blocks in Seattle, which kind of makes you feel good, but also maybe that's where we're heading. One of the other stories he talked about is what's happening in some of these cities where homelessness housing projects are being pushed. So you remember in Kenmore, they had this, what was supposed to be a project for low-income families, and then it morphed into a housing complex for people who are homeless and drug addicted. So Kenmore's like, no, we're not, no. They put their foot down. Inslee called them feckless, and they're like, screw you, man, we don't want it. And so that the city of Redmond was like, we'll take it, essentially. And they did the same thing that has created problems elsewhere. In Kentmore, in the Chinatown International District, they didn't consult the community. So you have these city leaders who want to be woke and do what the governor wants them to do without any care or concern for what their citizens might feel about the obvious implications of having a housing project for people who are getting out of homelessness and still drug addicted. That's going to have some sort of quality of life issues that come along with it. So if you genuinely care about your constituents, you should be seeking their input, not necessarily approval, but their input before you agree to move forward with the project. So I just wanted to update you because last night there was a rally at Redmond City Hall.
We do not want to see on our streets something that's happening in Seattle.
The rally is about getting people to have a say. The city council did this without taking any input from the residents, the taxpayers, and they just did it in secret.
So rescind the decision to give the public land to Plymouth Housing.
I know the governor has been very vocal about bringing homeless to all the cities in Eastside because he thinks Eastside should, you know, take the burden of that to help out. However, why should Eastside cities help with the mess that Seattle created for themselves?
I tend to agree it to a certain extent. Look, we're in this mess, and I would argue that Eastside communities help create this mess by voting for the people who are in power. The city of Redmond, their state senator is Monka Dhingra. So let's not act like, I'm not saying the people in that crowd, I don't know who they voted for, but let's not act like the East Side and voters on the East Side haven't contributed to the one-party monopoly that has pushed through the failed policies that have allowed homelessness to grow in Seattle and to spread to areas like Redmond, like Kenmore, whatever it is. Not to the extent of, obviously, of Seattle. I think the communities feeling the most of that growth are South King County. Voters created this. And so we're going to have to get ourselves out of the mess somehow. You can't just snap your fingers and you can't even just elect Republicans and then all of a sudden it's going to be fixed. We're too deep in it. But these things need to be built somewhere is what I'm saying, is you have to have housing options. It's a little cart before the horse because we're not even doing anything effective to get these people off the streets. So that's kind of like step one. Let's enforce the laws. Let's enforce the camping ordinances. Let's enforce the drug ordinances. Let's throw people in jail who are committing crimes to fund their drug habits and they're living on the streets. All of that needs to happen. And then when you give them the option of like jail or treatment and they pick treatment, you got to have somewhere for them to go. You have to have a long-term in-care residential facility where they're going to get help for their mental health issues. They're going to get help for their drug issues. And sometimes, yeah, I think it has to be involuntary. So you have to have these places somewhere or we're never going to get out of this mess. But I don't think it's NIMBYism, not in my backyardism, to want to say in it first, to expect your elected leaders who are supposed to serve you to have a number of public meetings, to have open dialogue with businesses, with community members, with law enforcement, to make sure that everyone's on the same page about how do we proceed from here. Because we've seen this doesn't work. Chinatown International District, Dow Constantine was trying to throw a homelessness complex down their throats without their input. And they were like, no, they had a protest. He ended up rescinding it. In Kenmore, citizens were like, no, they showed up. They ended up rescinding it. And now you're seeing that happen in Redmond because people don't feel listened to. So I disagree with the last gentleman who said, we're not going to deal with Seattle problems because by and large, King County, a lot of Snohomish County, and a chunk of Pierce County, they're voting for the people who are supporting these policies. So unless there's significant change there, like, yeah, it's all of our problems, right? But I just don't understand why yet another city would move forward with something like this, knowing the track record, without doing what they should do all along, but doing what they know they should do because of the implications and having people come to the table and discuss your concerns. Let's hash out the concerns, right? Let's acknowledge that our police forces have low staffing. What are they going to do? Are they going to be able to respond to an increase in crime or substance abuse and quality of life issues? Probably not. So what's our plan for that? This is basic stuff. This is the basic stuff of good governance. Yet we have so many elected leaders who fail at the basics. All right, coming up next, Jackson Maynard with the Citizen Action Defense Fund is going to join us to talk about a story we discussed on the show yesterday, how the Washington State Supreme Court now says you can become an attorney without passing the bar exam. So Jackson Maynard will weigh in on what does this really mean, and is this a bad idea? Is this an okay idea? Etc. I've been talking about my success on the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic program, down almost 40 pounds. And as much as I love talking about how well I've done and how good I feel and how much energy it's given me, I also love hearing the feedback from you guys who have done the program. I get texts from it's funny because I get texts from friends who are like, hey, FYI, I'm 2 months into Eastside. I was like, why didn't you tell me? They're like, oh, I didn't want to bother you. I was like, what? So we got an email from Jean. She says she's lost 28 pounds in 60 days, went from a size 16 to a size 8. size extra large shirt to a size medium. She says she's tried everything to lose weight. This has been the easiest plan she's ever had with the best results. And she also says her energy is better. She feels mentally stronger, more clear. Brandi, I can't thank you enough for sharing your experience with Eastside Weight Loss and how well you've been able to maintain your weight loss. That was one of the most important aspects to me in trying this program. Jean, congratulations. I know you feel good because I have been there quite literally. If you've been thinking about starting the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic program, the very first step is just scheduling a free 15-minute consultation with Dr. Ryan Coogan. You can do that virtually or over the phone. In fact, you can do the whole program virtually. You get a handy little app that walks you through everything. EastsideWeightLossClinic.com, EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. All right, you heard it here on the show yesterday. The Washington State Supreme Court has ruled, this from the Spokesman Review, that the bar exam will no longer be required to become an attorney in Washington State. The central argument is that requiring people who want to practice law to take the bar exam is racist, of course, because everything's racist, and that standard, for whatever reason, is having a disproportionate impact on people of color entering the legal profession. So we had a lot of questions yesterday when we heard this about, like, how big of a deal is this? How much would it reduce the quality of attorneys? Etc. I think there are a lot of implications to consider. So we asked our friend, our own attorney, Jackson Maynard with the Citizen Action Defense Fund, to come on and walk us through it. Jackson Maynard, welcome to Undivided.
Thank you, Brandi. Appreciate you having me on the show again.
Well, I got a question to ask you. I should have asked you this before you became my attorney. Did you pass the bar exam?
Yes, I did. I did pass the bar exam. It was 22 years ago. I remember it vividly because it was a horrible, horrible experience. But it's necessary in my mind because you need to be able to do it to be able to demonstrate your competency at the law.
Yeah. So just I sounds like an obvious question, but what is the bar exam?
So at the end of 3 years of law school, you take this exam every state offers it, I think, except now potentially Oregon has a separate pathway. But for years and years and years, states have had it where you take this exam at the end of your 3 years of law school, and it's over a 2-day period. Usually different states do it a little differently. And usually it's 6 hours, so 3 hours in the morning, 3 hours in the afternoon. And it tests you on all of the different areas of law. So there's a lot of information that you have to be able to distill under very, very difficult timed conditions with hundreds of other people in a giant room where your entire ability to do your profession is depending on it. And then they also have an essay component where you read a lot of material and you have to pull out the relevant facts and be able to, in essay form, describe and be able to analyze that quickly. So it's a very difficult, stressful experience. But, I do think it is important and it is necessary because, like in other professions, you know, to those, much is giving, much is required. So in medicine, there's also a stressful type of exam. You know, if you're an airline pilot, they have, you know, different requirements as well. Law enforcement, if you go into the military, again, you have great responsibility and you know, they have boot camp and where you have to demonstrate competency under very intense pressure-filled conditions. And so I think that is relevant to the legal profession in being able to show that you can, be competent in these different areas under very, you know, stressful conditions as the profession sometimes requires.
So what they're talking about now are these various pathways, and one of them sounds like kind of a glorified internship, so to speak. Do you believe that those sorts of pathways could effectively teach law students the same things that they might learn while studying for the bar exam?
Prior to there being bar exams, the tradition in this country and in England is you would read law. You would study under an apprenticeship of an attorney for a period of time. They would walk you through the text while you're working in a legal office. So there is that tradition. And I do think there is some value in sort of clerkships and experiential types of things in law school and programs. And for years, and this is noted in the task force report, the Washington State Bar Association has had a different non-law school pathway. It's called the Rule 6 program, where you could study under an attorney and then take the bar exam without having to go to law school. So they've been kind of playing with this, and I think there is some value in it. And certainly there's merit in trying to find ways to encourage lots of different groups to you know, who could be good lawyers to practice law. I think that's a worthy goal, because certainly, you know, some groups are underrepresented in the legal profession. And I think that's a worthy discussion of figuring out, are there barriers that don't affect the practice of law that we could look at? But in the end, I think having an exam that everybody has to take, an objective standard, everyone is forced to do and demonstrate the same knowledge in the same way to make sure that they can represent clients, because we're talking about people's life, liberty, and their property. I mean, if mistakes are made, and if people are not able to have the competency to represent, there could be enormous consequences for individual clients, in the same way that if you have doctors that can't function under pressure or demonstrate their mastery of knowledge, that can have horrible implications for patients. So I think there is value in having one test, even though I think the ways that you can attain the knowledge to take the test could maybe differ.
So let's talk about the two sort of issues at play here. You know, this had this racial component, which we'll get to round things out, but the competency component of it. I mean, I've met lawyers who did pass the bar who I didn't think were particularly good lawyers, you know, and then there's ones like you that are just A+, you know, top of the line, right? So there's some discrepancy, even for those who pass the bar, right? There's some discrepancy. But let's say, I mean, first of all, practically speaking, do you think law firms will hire someone who didn't pass the bar and went through one of these other means?
You know, I will say, just based on my experience in dealing with other lawyers, and I've had friends and relatives who have used the Rule 6 program to train lawyers and tutor folks, you know, to take the bar exam. So they use the program. I do think within the profession, there's going to be some skepticism. And I know just from talking to the lawyers, they're a little worried about what this could do to the profession. I'm glad the Bar Association, as part of the court order, will be looking at implementing this, and I hope there will be more conversations and opportunities. But I know that there is concern within the legal community and some of the lawyers I've spoken with about the impact that this could have on the practice of law here.
My big concern and question is that clients might use this to sort of get appeals. Like, if you have an attorney who didn't actually pass the bar, but you know, found another way in and they represent you in a criminal case and you are found guilty, do you think that could be a means to say, well, I didn't have competent counsel?
Whether or not, just based on the fact that my lawyer didn't pass the bar exam but was admitted to law in a different way, I think that would be an interesting issue for the court, since they okayed this process. It would be a little weird for them to say, oh, but lawyers that don't pass the bar aren't as good. And I think that would undermine that would be a little bit of a problem for them. But, you know, I think, again, to analogize it to a doctor, like, you know, would you really want to go to a doctor if the doctor didn't go to med school and just sort of like studied under another doctor for a while? I mean, they have residencies after they demonstrate certain competency in medical school. And there is, you know, a component of that for years. It's a part of the educational process, but I do have concerns about that. Sure.
Yeah. So let's talk about the racial component. I just find it to be a racist assertion that, like, you'd have to lower standards to get people of color to be able to become attorneys. Did you go to law school with people who weren't white?
I did. And you know, they're enjoying incredibly successful legal careers today. I think that's probably a little one of the more problematic parts of the task force report. I dug into that a little bit today, and even they admit that the data, where they're trying to say, oh, the bar exam itself is racist because there's a disproportionality in the report, it indicates that the data is incomplete. They have to go back to a report from 1998, and when they talk about the history of the bar exam as sort of a, you know, an element of racism or something, they're citing a Teen Vogue article, which I found a little odd. So I don't know that the scholarship underlying some of the conclusions in the report was completely fleshed out. You know, certainly I do think that in, as I mentioned, that certain minority groups are underrepresented in the legal profession. I think there can be a lot of different reasons for that. And I think it is worthy of kind of looking into, are there barriers in place? That said, again, when you're dealing with professions that can have severe consequences with people, I do think it does make sense to have higher burdens, that you can make sure that they have the skill level to make sure that they don't harm people through mistake or lack of qualifications. And so I thought it was somewhat ironic, and this kind of ties into our conversation, that they felt like allowing more people who hadn't passed the bar would help solve the problem for this a lack of public defenders that they're studying and looking at and kind of setting new standards. Because I think, who you want to have the best counsel if you're facing a criminal charge is somebody, the highest level of professionalism and counsel is your public defender or someone that's representing you, where you could have your life or liberty at stake. And so the idea that, I think there's a little bit of a tension there, the idea that we would, this could be a tool to get more lawyers to people in these, in this situation where you really need to have competent counsel by sort of watering down the standards. That troubles me a little bit.
Yeah, that doesn't seem like it makes a lot of sense. All right, Jackson. Well, thank you for explaining this to us. I'm glad you did pass the bar. I, for one, think that's a good thing and preferable. And we'll have you back on soon.
Great. Thank you, Brandy. I appreciate it.
Always appreciate it. I had to ask him, are you white? Because I was like, oh, maybe we have an attorney of color coming on to talk about this. Because I was like, I can't tell. He's got Eastern European, which apparently is white. So, but anyway, yeah, I just don't know how to feel about it. I mean, I think that it's important, like he said, in the medical field and, policing, you have all these standards for people to make sure individuals are taken care of and that they don't hurt somebody. And I mean, there are a few situations in your life that you need someone as competent as when you're standing before a judge and like your freedom's on the line. So the fact that this is sort of a hope to fill the ranks of public defenders, don't you already complain that people of color are disproportionately like in need of public defenders? So now you're going to give them the attorneys who are likely least qualified to be in a court of law? Doesn't that seem counterintuitive to you? Very strange, but we appreciate Jackson Maynard's insight. All right, if you are thinking about selling your home in 2024, and maybe you're just waiting anxiously for the Fed to drop interest rates, the very best thing you can do is make sure that your home is ready to hit the market the moment that happens. Wes of sellwithwes.com says that even if the Fed doesn't drop interest rates, I mean, it's forecasted it's going to, it's likely it probably will before the end of the year, he still does believe that there's going to be an uptick in home sales in 2024 compared to 2023.
If they stay where they're at right now, I actually think that values will stay closer to where they're at. We'll see lower appreciation. We'll see appreciation, but it'll be modest. But if they start to come back down, well, that's when I think we'll start to see more of the multiple offer situations and the bid ups in home sale prices.
Yeah. So you want to be ready when and if that happens. Make sure you visit sellwithwes.com, sellwithwes.com. He's going to start by giving you a market analysis so you know how well your home is positioned. And then he can talk to you about things like the Listing Boost Concierge Service. Let's say you want to make some cosmetic upgrades to your home so that you get a better price when it hits the market. Well, they can help manage those projects and they can even help you pay for it up front. Totally stress-free. So sellwithwes.com. Start by using their home value calculator to see how much your home is worth. It might be worth more than you think. Sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. Apparently, some mayors in our state are charging people an admission fee to attend their state of the city addresses. Let's talk about it in our segment. Unbelievable. All right, let's take you to the city of Everett, where I have been very complimentary of the mayor, Mayor Cassie Franklin. She's a Democrat, but she has really stood firm on some public safety issues, so she's gotten a lot of applause from me. This is a big miss for her. I don't understand this. She's not alone. I'll get to that in a moment. But this is the first I've ever heard of this. And I've been covering politics for a while. So she is about to deliver her State of the City address, which we typically see from mayors that give the State of the City, the governor gives the State of the State, and then, of course, you have the State of the Union. State of the City address. Well, would you pay $35 to attend the mayor of Everett's State of the City address? Because that is the price of admission. This is from the Everett Herald. At Everett Mayor's keynote speech, $35 entry and a Boeing partnership. It says, before Mayor Cassie Franklin's annual State of the City speech Thursday at the Everett Mall, attendees will hear 10 minutes of remarks from the event's main sponsors, aviation giant Boeing and real estate developer Mortensen. Entry to the event will also cost $35, part of a broader trend of commercializing and charging admission to keynote speeches that makes some open government advocates cringe. The city will not make any money from the event, city spokesperson Simone Tarver said. Any revenue will pay for food and rental costs, while profit will be retained by the event's host, Economic Alliance of Snohomish County. Okay. The article goes on to talk a little bit more about all the sponsors that are involved in putting this event on. Again, this is a State of the City address. It says the event's prime sponsors are Boeing, obviously, which operates a huge production facility in Everett and falls under city regulations, and Mortensen, a company that has led several projects around Everett, including construction for Everett Community College and Providence Regional Medical Center, Everett. The Port of Everett, Alaska Airlines, and One World are also sponsors of the event. Additional sponsors include Herald Media, North Sound Media, Puget Sound LISC, Hotel Bellwether, Village Theater, Everett Music Initiative, the Everett Aqua Sox, the Everett Silvertips, the Shack Arts Center, Sound to Summit, Brewery, Artisans, Book and Coffee, and NGMA Group. The event's website lists amenities included in the cost of admission, like catering, raffle entries, and networking opportunities. Networking is allocated for 1 hour and 15 minutes on the event's agenda following Franklin's speech. Economic Alliance members get a $5 discount. What the hell is going on? What the hell is this?
If you have sponsors, the sponsors typically would pick up the cost.
So there are multiple problems here.
Oh my gosh.
This is freaking wild. It's the State of the City address for Everett. Why are you having some big full-blown event around it? I'm not saying what's happening in Everett isn't important. I'm not saying that Everett Mayor Cassie Franklin shouldn't deliver an address. But it's not, you're not the president, you know? I just don't get the appeal of having an event around a State of the City address. But as Nicole said, let's say for some reason you want to, right? You want to do all these things and you're like, yeah, but we don't want the taxpayers to pay for it. I appreciate that. Like, I appreciate the taxpayers not paying for it if you're going to do this. But if you have sponsors, why are you then also charging a $35 admission fee? Which might price out some of your constituents who want to come and watch you deliver a State of the City address. Now, I charge for speeches. If I'm going to speak to a non-charity event, I charge. I have a speaking fee. I'm not a government official, and it's not part of my duties to inform my constituents on the state of the city. If you are the mayor of a city, all you should be doing is showing up to a city council meeting or setting up a podium at City Hall, delivering your 10 minutes if you feel like you need to do a speech, and then letting people watch it on the internet. There's no reason it has to be a $50,000 production with food and appetizers and networking and giant corporate sponsors. How many freaking sponsors does one event need, let alone a State of the City event? This is way out of the realm of what's necessary and what's reasonable. And obviously some government watchdogs have an issue with it for a variety of reasons. One, you're forcing constituents, if they want to come watch this speech from their mayor about the state of the city, to pay a fee. But also, it was sort of interesting, they were like, you could also violate the Public Meetings Act if you have, you know, too many council members present and they're sitting at the same table talking about city business. So now they need to like sit at separate tables so they can't communicate with each other. It's all just really dumb. And I will say Mayor Cassie Franklin isn't the only mayor who is apparently doing this. So over in Spokane, this has been done for several years now under mayors from both political parties. So this year, Lisa Brown, this is the costs to attend her State of the City address. If you want a corporate table, it's $500. If you want just a regular in-person ticket, $60, $75 for a non-member. A vegan ticket, oh, Nicole, oh, it's only $75. It's the same price. I thought they were going to upcharge the vegan. Oh, whatever. No, oh, there is a gluten-free, same ticket price. Mm-hmm. And then Mayor Victoria Woodard, I always mix up the Woodard and the Woodards. Nadine Woodward, sorry, in Spokane when she was, and she's a Republican, she was charging $55 per ticket. This makes no, and in Bellevue, apparently they also charge. How am I just now hearing about this? I'm not trying to diminish the hard job of a mayor and the importance of the job of mayor, but it doesn't rise to the level of you needing to put on a $50,000 event to give your State of the City address and to charge the people you serve to hear it in person. Honestly, tape a video. Tape a video of you delivering it. Hell, pipe in some applause if that's what you need. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it is. But to have an event with catering, with meet and greets, making people pay the price of admission to shake your hand and clap for you, that's insane. Not to mention what I think is a conflict of interest in having corporate sponsors who the city is responsible for regulating. Do you really think, I mean, all the issues with Boeing right now, I don't know if any of them are back to the Everett factory, but do you think if the mayor of Everett was having serious issues with Boeing or Mortenson Construction, that Mayor Cassie Franklin would feel that she could criticize them openly during a speech that they have sponsored for an event they have helped sponsor and pay for? Of course not. And now you've got this long, long list of corporate sponsors, Port of Everett, Alaska Airlines, all of the media companies. What the hell are media companies doing sponsoring a State of the City address?
Well,
that
me,
is
off,
wild.
It comes off as advertising to me, as a promotional
right.
thing.
Right, they want the advertising, but it's a conflict of interest for the city.
You're paying to go get promoted to?
And the only people who are going to pay for this are people who want to, you know, shake hands and make deals. Mm-hmm. And, you know, get on the mayor's good side or whatever it is. That's all this is. So this is a ripe opportunity for problems. So this practice needs to end this year, now that it's getting some attention. There is no city government, no mayor who should be having an event around their State of the City address. Not even Seattle, who should have an event around their State of the City address, let alone charge admission and accept corporate sponsors for companies they're in charge of regulating. This is conflict of interest 101. So I'm curious, you guys in the comments, what do you think of this? Would you ever attend?
Yeah, what
would you buy a ticket?
Would you pay to
what mayor
hear?
Would you pay
yeah.
to hear? There was a couple cities they were giving credit to for not in the City of Everett. I want to see which one it was. Hold on a second. Yeah, it says last year Bellevue charged $65 for general admission to $65 to watch the mayor of Bellevue speak.
I mean,
at a State of the City address.
People don't pay, you know, just, well, I guess it's campaigning, but you don't pay to see the president unless there's
Congress.
Some special fundraiser or something.
Exactly.
It's crazy.
Hey, should I be charging $65 an episode to sit here and talk to people for an hour? I'm certainly more exciting
well,
than mayor
than one
of the mayors. $5. I do five shows
way
a week
cheaper.
For $5 a month. Mm-hmm. And they want to deliver a boring ass speech for $65? Stop it. It said other cities in Snohomish County, Marysville, Linwood, they don't have admission. So that's normal. You shouldn't have admission. If you feel like you need to have some big event that you have to pay for, have a fundraiser or something for something going on, or have a fundraiser to pay citizens back and some taxes. I don't even know.
Networking.
I don't
understand the draw of this.
It's becoming more and more common. It's got to stop this year. I don't want to see any more of this. Like, this is really insane.
Brandy said so.
I said
no
so.
More.
So it has to absolutely stop this year. I just don't know who would want to do that.
I don't. I really am curious who pays to go.
It's people
to
want
that.
A glad hand and like make friends in high places, relatively high places. But again, on the hierarchy of like, there is no.
I don't.
There's no mayor in the
Even
state
if you're
who
the,
I'd pay to go watch
the
State
person,
City address.
Why are you paying to go to this event?
Can you imagine paying to be bored to tears for 20 minutes?
Right.
I'm not paying for that. Doesn't matter how much booze I get, courtesy of Boeing.
That's
that would
crazy.
Take a lot of.
And especially because you can watch it afterwards. So what are you paying for?
It's about relationship
understand.
Building.
But it's not really.
It's crazy. Okay,
crazy.
If you're heading to retirement, this year is going to be a rocky, rocky ride with the presidential election, global unrest, economic stories that you can't even trust, the president feeding you all sorts of nonsense about how the economy is doing. So are you confident in this environment about your retirement portfolio? If the answer is no, or if the answer is, I'm not sure if I'm confident or not, I recommend attending the latest risk management strategy live webinar that Zach Abraham and his team are hosting. It's coming up Thursday, March 28th at 3:30 p.m. It's a webinar, so you can just attend it from the comfort of your home. It is their 2024 Outlook webinar. So it's going to look at all the things happening this year and you know how that impacts the volatility of the market and what they can do and what they do at Bulwark to try to protect retirement portfolios against risk. So don't miss Zach's free 2024 Outlook Live webinar. Again, Thursday, March 28th. You could register right now at knowyourriskradio.com. That's knowyourriskradio.com. Investment advisory services offered through Trek Financial LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. Investments involve risk and are not guaranteed. Past performance doesn't guarantee future results. Okay, Nicole is very happy about this clip we're going to play. And I am going to listen to it for the first time with all of you because Nicole was sitting over there cutting it and she was like, and I was like, oh, it must be good because Nicole's having a giggle fest over there. So it has to do with a congressional hearing, which you all know, I just think that they're absolutely worthless at this point. Although sometimes they can be entertaining. And if Nicole's giggling is any indication, this was very entertaining. So it has to do with Kentucky Senator John Kennedy, who's questioning an Olympia cross-country skier who is at a, this is a hearing on climate change and the climate, right? So apparently this Olympian cross-country skier is a big climate advocate. And Kentucky Senator John Kennedy, in his questioning, kind of points out that, like, man, based on your social media posts, seems like you're an advocate for an awful lot of stuff.
When my colleagues invite witnesses to come to us to tell us, advise us on passing legislation, I always check out the background of our witnesses, because I like to know who I'm talking to. I checked yours out, Mr. Schumacher, and I want to be sure I understand it as I evaluate your testimony. On June 8, 2020, you tweeted, I'm going to quote, "The war on drugs was intentionally created to incarcerate black people en masse," end quote. Who intentionally created the war on drugs to put black people in jail? Who were you talking about?
I don't remember typing that.
You don't?
No.
It's on your Twitter feed.
Maybe a retweet. I don't know. I haven't used that in a while.
Well, also, even it if it's a retweet, like it shows your support, right?
Maybe, yeah. But it's not the topic of this conversation, I think.
Right. But it has to do with you're here giving us advice, and I just kind of like to know a little bit more about your
perspective. I'm here as an athlete giving you my story and what I've seen.
Quote, I'm going to quote, "Police are paid with taxpayer dollars. If they are not answerable to us, we can demand new service," and that's what this is. "Abolish the police in favor of that new service," end quote. You think we ought to abolish the police, do you?
Again, not the topic I'm here to talk about today.
I know, but you tweeted it. Do you think we ought to abolish the police?
That's not what I'm here to talk about.
Should we do that before or after we get rid of fossil fuels?
I'm not going to address that.
You don't want to address it. Okay. Your words, not mine. It's on your Twitter feed. Quote, "This is what systemic racism looks like. The Los Angeles Police Department is literally policing only the Black Lives Matter side," end quote. What'd you mean by that?
This is still off topic.
No, it's not. You're here as an expert telling us, advising us, and I'm asking you about your background.
I'm here as an athlete to talk about the effects of climate change on my sport.
Okay, let's go back. Well, I'm almost out of time.
Senator, you're well out of time, and we have other senators waiting, so please wrap up when you have a moment.
All right. Thank you all for your testimony.
It's just funny because it's like, and it's Louisiana Senator John Kennedy. Sorry, I think I said Kentucky. It's just funny because we've seen this over and over where they'll invite someone who's like an expert on something and they're an expert. And then it's like, man, they've acted like an expert on every other issue as well. Or they have all these tweets. I'm trying to remember the woman who, or was it a woman? Maybe a person who no longer identifies as a woman who's born a woman. I don't remember. But gosh, I can't remember what it was. But then somebody sat and, oh, it was, you know, she was testifying on like dangerous rhetoric on the internet or something. And they're pulling up all her old tweets, like all these hate filled things.
Oh,
and I'm like,
oh
man, that's a disaster.
But
it's also like, this is just, they never vet their witnesses. And it's like, you can't, if you want to someone, this is an Olympic skier, Gus Shoemaker. And if you want him to come in and be taken seriously as an expert witness on the climate related to what the climate is doing to his sport of skiing, then you should probably do your due diligence to make sure that he's like also not just some like left-wing fanatic who'll like speak out about anything left-wing. Mm-hmm. So it's just this really odd failure to vet people who come before Congress. Now, I'm not saying he can't have his opinions, right? But it's clear that like his opinions are just based solely on like ideology. And so he's going to come there and talk from a perspective of ideology and probably knows nothing about the impacts climate actually has on skiing. Like probably hasn't looked into it too much, but just likes the way it sounds. So
I love the, should we do that? Abolish the police before or after we deal with the climate issues?
Which one's first? Abolish the police first and then the climate? Or like, I don't know, is there overlap
Senator
there?
Kennedy is one of my favorites because he's so smooth. It seems like everybody respects him and he's just very smooth and concise and I appreciate him.
His staff does a good job. I don't think Senator Kennedy is on
his
Twitter.
Delivery, though.
Yes, no, I agree. But definitely his staff does a good job at preparing him for those hearings. But
yes,
so anyway, okay, before we get to questions and comments, I want to talk about a poll I put up last night. So if you're like, Brandy, there was no Daily Show poll today. It was because I put it up last night. And it's a very, very important one. So if you are a subscriber, I need you to take this poll. It will be up for another 24 hours because it is the poll to choose our 2024 Charity of the Year. Subscribers who are on our charity team sent in their nominations. We reviewed them and we have chosen three options for you to vote on for our Charity of the Year. The Coffee Oasis, the Washington State Patrol Memorial Foundation, and Kent Hope. So subscribers will vote on these nominees and we will choose a Charity of the Year and then find ways that we can give back to that charity throughout the year. I'll tell you just a little bit about each of them. The Coffee Oasis was founded in 1997. It provides youth ages 13 to 25 with mentorship, goal setting, job training, shelter, and crisis services. It's funded in part by proceeds from its cafes across Puget Sound. It is a community-based approach to helping youth who are dealing with abuse, homelessness, depression, or addiction. Second option, the Washington State Patrol Memorial Foundation. There were a lot of nominations of this that were sort of late to the game, of course, because we had the passing, the murder of Trooper Christopher Gadd. So the Washington State Patrol Memorial Foundation is dedicated to caring for our heroes and their families when there's a death or an injury. They added, obviously, another name to their list of fallen troopers this year with Trooper Christopher Gadd, who left behind a wife and a daughter. So the WSP Memorial Foundation will help Trooper Gadd's family with financial needs, just as it does for the families of other fallen and injured troopers. And the final choice, charity number three, Kent Hope. So over the past decade, Kent Hope has helped more than 760 women and their children find housing and critical services. It's a day center, so they give women and their children a place they can come in off the streets, get a warm meal, find resources like job training and housing. They can also access clothing, laundry machines, personal hygiene supplies, etc. They are part of the Union Gospel Mission family. So if you are a subscriber, please take time in the next 24 hours to vote on your choice for Undivided's 2024 Charity of the Year. A lot of good nominations in. Sometimes when we're looking at what to choose, if something's been nominated more than once, we kind of tend to gravitate toward that. So these are three good options in three different areas. All right, questions and comments. Baron of Gray Matter with a $5 super chat. How was your bank account and buying power in 2018? We were energy independent and helping Europe with their gas supplies, etc. Yes, Biden is at fault related to higher gas prices. I do put blame there, But when it comes to the ebb and flow, there are a variety of factors. But overall, I mean, obviously gas prices are substantially higher under Biden than they were under Trump. Adorable, deplorable, don't worry, dudes. This state's got the highest minimum wage in the nation. We can afford higher gas prices. Yep, some people can. Brent Davis with a $4.99 super chat. Brandy, do you know anything about what's going on with the Byrd and the Pierce County, Semi Byrd and the Pierce County convention? Also, you should encourage Dave to debate Semi and you should host it. I'm not 100% sure. I feel like there was something out there about, like, remember when the debate was going to happen and then didn't happen, and like Semi Byrd preemptively said, I'm going to debate Dave Ryker, and Dave Reichert's team's like, we haven't agreed to that yet. It hasn't been formalized. And then Pierce County's like, we're not doing a debate. So that made Semi Byrd supporters all mad at the Pierce County Republican Party. In fact, I don't even think Semi Byrd was invited to the Pierce County convention. I don't think so. That's sort of the beef there. But no, I don't think Dave needs to do a debate before the general election. I mean, or before the general election. I mean, I'm all for debates, but yeah, look, I don't know how many times I can say this. Semi Byrd has no money. He has no money and he has no potential to win. And there's this really loud, vocal minority of even Republicans who are very similar to what we saw with Lauren Culp, very like attacking, you know, Dave Reichert and all these things. And I get it. Like, they're excited about Semi Byrd. Semi Byrd is very convincing in person, I will say that. But his baggage is just too much. And if you think that Democrats won't use his baggage against him, that's wild. I mean, they have endless baggage, court martial, gun charge, all this stuff to use against Semi Byrd, and they will. So I don't know that Dave, I think Dave's team probably feels like debating Semi Byrd will be helping Semi Byrd's campaign by giving him more attention. You got to earn your attention on your own. So I don't know. I'm not going to host a debate between Dave and Semi. I mean, if they're going to do it and somebody asks me, I also don't think that would be fair because I've endorsed Dave Reichert. If you're Semi Byrd, you wouldn't want a moderator who's endorsed your opponent. That doesn't seem fair. So I think it would have to be someone who's neutral in that regard. But yeah, that's all I really know about the beef situation, if there is a beef. Jackie McWalter Huff says, Puget Sound voters caused this, the most populated area. Are you talking about homelessness, right? Nicole used to put the subjects in there for me.
Sorry, it's the Redmond story that she's talking about.
She says, Puget Sound voters caused this. The most populated area has crowd mentality on a lot of issues. It's frustrating because there are people in the Puget Sound region with common sense, but they aren't loud and charismatic to sway the majority, which then we get crazy. We need more voices of common sense to sway the crowd in the most popular region so common sense will prevail. Hey, we're trying. That's what we're trying every single day. Kathy McDonald says, paying to watch a State of the City address, I wouldn't pay two bits to hear any politician talk about anything. All these people do is try to figure out how to take more and more from people. And look, if it was a private event, a fully private event that wasn't the state of the city, sure, go there, Cassie Franklin, you speak, charge an admission fee, you know, whatever it is. But this shouldn't be an event that has an admissions fee. It's very strange. On the bar exam going away, or at least not going away, but not being a requirement for everyone to become an attorney, Trisha, not tall, but small, says, as a person who took the bar and passed it, I am disgusted by the reasoning of the court. I agree. Greg Olakis, again, on the State of the City admissions fee, charging a fee to hear a public official who works for the public is criminal. Yeah, I agree. Leah and Matt both had comments on Senator Kennedy's questioning of the Olympic skier. Leah said, never thought I would be such a big fan of Senator Kennedy. His questions are always fire. Matt Gilbert said, my new life goal is to get some representative to read my tweets into the record, right? Oh, man. As long
as
it's
like... You
get
enough attention on your
Nicole
tweets,
Nicole and I laugh all the time about Matt's tweets. We're like, Matt's a savage. Yeah. Like, stuff we might be thinking, but we would absolutely never say. Mm-hmm. Matt does it, and Matt does it for us. All right, we'll get to our closing sanity check next, which is an indicator of what is to come in Washington State if we do not do more to make sure that tenants and squatters aren't taking advantage of hardworking landlords. First, I have encouraged you guys over and over and over and over again to take the First Mark Challenge. Why? Well, they're a sponsor of our show, number one. But two, I love them. And Mike and I are members of the First Mark family. And for everyone who needs insurance, which is every single one of you, it's a no-brainer. First Mark Insurance, when you take the First Mark Challenge, they'll go through all your current insurance. They'll talk to you about your insurance needs. Maybe you need better insurance. Maybe you need a better price. They'll go out for free. They'll shop the market for you. And then they'll come back to you with their recommendations. And you can decide, do I join the First Mark family or not? And have them handle all of this for me for free, so I can just sit back and relax. Dave Taylor is the CEO of First Mark.
I really want to encourage folks, don't try to navigate this current market by yourself. Mm-hmm. I believe you need to get with a broker. Okay, obviously I'd love them to come to First Mark, but at a minimum, they need to be with a broker that works with numerous carriers that can give them the advice they need and really help them navigate this right now, because it's complicated.
Yeah, definitely complicated. And if you can have someone navigate it for you for free, why would you not? FirstMarkInsurance.com, FirstMarkInsurance.com. The very, very best part is they work for you, not for the insurance companies. And with that, let's get to our closing sanity check. So we have had a lot of stories on the show about the situation with tenant and landlords in Washington State. I mean, in Seattle, it's already gotten really bad. We told you about the story of the quote-unquote homeless Seattle landlord, Jason Roth, who at 32 years old, you know, rehabbed a house in South Seattle, started renting it out to a guy who never paid him, squatted in it for a year, is finally out. And then we just talked this week about the situation in Bellevue, where you've got a professional squatter who does this seemingly for a living and has been in some guy's house now for 2 years. And because the system protects tenants so much, and not just tenants, actual squatters, because they have so many rights under our system, it has led to a little bit of vigilante justice. I mean, in the Bellevue case, they had 100 citizens who are now going out there every Saturday to protest this guy who refuses to pay rent in this Bellevue home. And they're just hoping, like, hey, no, the government isn't doing anything. All the laws are screwed up. So we're just going to go out and shame this guy in front of his house every weekend until he decides to move out. And that's what it's come to. But also, and we talked about this and mentioned it, I worry about what's going to happen to landlords who start to fight back. Because again, nobody's helping them. They're in this situation where they own a home that they are responsible for paying the mortgage on. And they don't have access to it. They can't get someone out who's not paying to be there. In the case of the Bellevue guy, he filed an order of protection against the landlord who's been out there at these protests. Think about that. The guy's living in his house. He's stealing money from him, which is what it is when you don't pay rent. And now he's got an order of protection against him. That's crazy. So for a whole new level of crazy, there is a story out of New York where a woman who inherited a property from her parents is fed up. She is fed up. There's legit squatters who are squatting in this $1 million house. It's not a big house. I mean, home prices in New York are about what they are here. So very modest house. But she has squatters who have been living there, refusing to leave. She's trying to sell the thing. And so she goes to try to get them out. And she is the one who ends up getting arrested. Here's a clip of a story out of New York.
Less than 10 minutes after police left and the locks were changed. The man who claims to be the one actually leasing the house shows up.
Call the police again.
With the other guy, police took off the property.
Do you see this? This guy just literally broke down my door. Broke through myself and my daughter to get in here. This guy just forced himself into my house.
No, he did not.
Yes, he did.
No, he didn't.
And so did you.
Ma'am.
You broke through the front door.
Officer.
The man called the police on her.
So why is it that I have to leave and he doesn't have to leave?
Because technically he can't be kicked out. You need to go to court.
They consider this a landlord-tenant issue. And by law, it has to be handled through the housing court, not with police.
If you own this house, you would not want her inside.
I don't own the house. I don't own this.
Exactly. Yes. She does.
Yes. But then once again, you should know how the law works.
I do know how it works.
There's rules to the as you got to go to court and send me to civil court.
He says he signed a lease in October, but wouldn't tell us with who.
I got proof longer than that.
Show us the proof.
But who are you for me to show? I showed it to cops.
Dan with Channel 7 News. If you don't want to show it, you don't want to show it.
Pool. Come here, brother. I like that.
I would like to see it.
He didn't show me a lease.
This is a bill.
A bill for work he says he had done to the house. He didn't show police a lease either.
The police department doesn't have the lease?
No.
He's got no documentation.
Just bills.
So, Adele, you're getting arrested right now?
I'm being arrested.
For what?
For being in my own home.
And where's your lease?
She's fighting the house. It's not her house anymore.
My deed is current and legal.
Arrested for unlawful eviction. She changed the locks on a man who claims he lives there.
So how does this all end then? When do you leave?
The way it ends is either she pays me my money that I put into the house, pay me the money, and I'll leave, or send me to court, and we deal with the judge in court. It's that simple.
Oh my God. Is this the crazy train? Is this where the crazy train ends? How did we get to this point? How can anyone see that and not realize we have to do something? We're talking about a modest home in Flushing, Queens that this woman inherited from her parents, and she's trying to sell it. She thinks she gets some squatters out. She changes the locks. This guy who claims he has a lease with someone who she says, you don't have a lease with me. I'm the homeowner. Says he did work to the house, and now she owes him for work she didn't even ask to be done. She doesn't even know who this guy is. She doesn't even know who he has a lease with. He didn't even show a lease to the police or the reporter. And the police arrested her for unlawful eviction. Honestly, shame on those police officers. I love the police, but to me, you should be in that moment, use your judgment, and realize that's not right. Like, I can use my judgment as a member of law enforcement and say, this is not right. Now, I understand that in that situation, they might be worried that there's going to be a fight or some sort of violence or whatever it is, but you choose to put this woman in handcuffs and take her away. And this is what the system has created, whether it's, you know, Jason Roth all over the news talking about this guy who squatted in his house, putting his face everywhere, whether it's in Bellevue, neighbors showing up and protesting outside a guy's house, posting pictures of him as a con man all over the neighborhood so he can't go anywhere without feeling shamed, or whether it's this woman in Flushing, New York, who decided, hey, I'm just going to go and I'm going to change the locks and see what happens, and ends up in handcuffs. The system and the government hates working class people. They hate hardworking, law-abiding people. I mean that because if it weren't true, the rules would not be what they are. The policies and the laws would not be what they are. They are policies that work against people who are doing nothing wrong and protect people who are doing everything wrong. That is insane, and it has to change. That has been our sanity check for today, and that has been today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. Reminder, Undivided subscribers, please go vote today on who your choice is for our 2024 Charity of the Year. That poll will be open to subscribers for about another 24 hours. So we will see you back here on the live show tomorrow at noon.